I've been asked to give a kind of introductory overview of Thomas Aquinas's understanding of our free agency. So that's what I'm going to do this morning in the time that I have. What I'd like to do is proceed in the same mode that St. Thomas recommends we proceed when we're developing a science or our understanding of a certain topic matter. The first thing we need to do is ask whether there is such a thing as free will or free agency, and we know that today we live in a society in which there are many people who simply deny that there is such a thing as free will. St. Thomas doesn't have an extensive discussion in terms of an argument that we have free will. He takes it something of a given, but he does have a kind of elaboration of a sort of argument that we have free will. The gist of it I've put on the board over here on your right, which is the quote, "Human beings have free will. Otherwise, counsels, exhortations, commands, prohibitions, rewards, and punishments would be in vain." In other words, those activities, counseling, exhorting, commanding, prohibiting, rewarding, and punishing, would be senseless. We wouldn't be able to understand them, or worse, they'd be a kind of external form of control over people if they were not in some way an appeal to a capacity we have as rational to make free choices. Aquinas thinks it's more or less a given that those things are not in vain, and so he thinks we have free will. That's a kind of argument that he gives. We can discuss that in more detail later on if you'd like, but we'll take it as a given in here that we have free will. The question becomes, what are its properties and what is it? In order to know what it is, the essence of free will, let's take a moment to consider its properties, and let's start with our experience of free will. For a lot of people today, we experience our free will, I guess you could say the ordinary way we experience or live it, is as an ability to opt for something. You go into a restaurant, for example, a menu is set before you, and you have a whole set of options. And what you do is you opt for one of the options that are set before you. Or you go to buy a car, there's a number of options set before you on the lot, and different types of models and makes, and you opt for one vehicle or another. You go to a supermarket and many options are set before you, and you simply opt for this or that. That's how we tend to think of our freedom or free will, is as this ability to simply opt for one of the things set before us. And in a world of proliferating options, we tend to experience and interpret our own free will increasingly more and more that way. One of the ways that we tend to think of our freedom or free will in our contemporary context is that this ability to opt is unguided. It's not guided by rational norms or by truth or anything like that. You simply are able, or free as we say, to opt as you please, to opt according to desire or passion or whatever it may be in terms of your appetites. So it's unguided ability to opt for something. And furthermore, this unguided ability to opt for one thing or another is considered sacred. Now, sometimes that terminology is used, the sacredness of this interior ability to opt, but in an increasingly agnostic or atheistic society that sees almost nothing as sacred or doesn't even want to use the term sacred, it's sometimes just said to be the most intimately personal or something like that, something that is at the heart of our very being as persons, okay? On this understanding of free will, our norms, laws, any attempt to guide action or guide our free choices is usually understood as external, coming from without. It's an imposition, usually with some kind of authority or power behind it, and it's considered a threat. A threat precisely to that sacred space, we could call it, within, or that intimately personal interior place where we opt as we wish for one thing or another in the field of options. And to go even further, not only are norms and laws or principles, moral principles, considered external impositions or threats, but we tend to think of this freedom or free will as the ability to make of myself absolutely whatever I want. Absolutely whatever I want. So unlimitedness seems to be an essential feature of free will as we experience it and interpret it in our contemporary context. Now, one place to show that this is not just a philosophical game or a thought experiment in the abstract or just simply a classroom and theoretical discussion, there are places where this understanding of freedom has been enshrined in law by political power. And one place where it seems to be most evidently at play is in the famous case, Supreme Court case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1993, which contains the following passage that many people, not just conservatives, find rather mysterious or mystifying even. It goes like this, quote, this is the Supreme Court, quote, "At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Beliefs about these matters could not define the attributes of personhood were they formed under the compulsion of the state," end quote. So what is at the heart of liberty or freedom or free will? It's the right to define your own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. That is what we could call an understanding of freedom as absolutely unlimited autonomy. Okay? That's how it's understood. Okay? Just to show that my description of freedom or its properties is that I gave was not just a kind of thought experiment. That's how actual people with political power think about it and have attempted to make normative in our society. But let's step back from that experience. We could say our ordinary way of thinking about freedom as we experience it or interpret it in our society as this unguided ability to opt and make up one's own, make of oneself whatever we want. Let's think about its properties in another way. Let's listen to St. Thomas Aquinas and the tradition of which he's part. What are some of the properties of our free will that are pointed out in that tradition or understanding of things? The first thing we can say about human beings or our free agency, more specifically, is that it is ordered to our overall well-being, or it's ordered to happiness. Okay? All human beings by nature desire or are inclined towards happiness, towards the fulfillment of our very being. The understanding is that we are beings of desire, beings of love, many loves, many appetites, but one overarching appetite, one overarching love, which is the desire for happiness. Happiness here is not understood as just a feeling, or a mood, or a sentiment, or an affective configuration. It's understood as a kind of overall well-being, meaning our whole being as humans is somehow brought to fulfillment or realization. We can think of our end, our telos, as human beings, our final end, if that's happiness, and we understand happiness not just as a feeling or a sentiment, but as our overall well-being. How do we understand overall well-being now? We can understand that in terms of human nature. That's how St. Thomas does it, following not only Aristotle but others. Here's a human being, you or I. We'll have to qualify this in a minute because it starts out making it look rather individualistic, whereas overall well-being is a much more social situation. It's not just an individual's well-being. It's just overall social well-being for the human race as a whole, okay? The individual has a certain nature, a first nature. Our first nature is that of being human, as distinct from being dogs, cats, or things of other natures. Okay? And our nature has certain propensities and requirements written into it by nature. And not just for human beings, but for other animals as well. Okay? So perhaps we could agree up front that there are certain things that fulfill natures and or serve the well-being, the overall fulfillment and realization of those natures. And there are certain things that, what? Subvert those natures, undermine them, warp them, destroy them, basically. So if we feed dog food to a cat or cat food to a dog or the wrong kinds of things to a fish, then basically the things don't flourish. They're undermined, they're subverted, they're destroyed in certain ways. Fire, as it were, is destructive of the nature of an individual tree. We can say that it doesn't cause it to flourish as such. Okay, so it undermines it. Things are called poisons because there are certain types of nutrients that actually undermine, warp and destroy things according to the natures that they have. You can poison a cat, you can poison a dog, you can do things that subvert or undermine their overall well-being, their flourishing. Likewise, similar things happen to human beings or can happen in us, to our lives, the way that we proceed to our persons. We can choose things, or let's say there are certain things, let's just put it vaguely at first, that can fulfill our nature and lead us towards overall well-being. And there are certain things that can divert us, undermine it, take us away, or warp us in such a way that we don't arrive at overall well-being. Okay? That's the basic large picture that we get in Thomas Aquinas. Now, there's an important point to make here, that there's a significant distinction between animals and human beings precisely about this picture. So the picture we have here is very general. It can apply to human beings, it can apply to animals. Animals less than human beings, we could say, the brutes, as the old expression is in the writings of Aquinas. The animals that are not human beings, they make their way from a kind of initial condition, which they have their first nature, to overall well-being, and they make that their way by instinct. Okay, by instinct. Now, St. Thomas and Aristotle are both quite well aware that not all individual animals make their way towards their overall well-being. They don't always do that. What he says, though, is that they do so always or for the most part. Nature works always or for the most part. So always or for the most part, animals make their way towards their overall well-being, okay? Understood socially regarding their whole species, okay? Always or for the most part, they do so. He's quite well aware that here and there, and maybe in certain circumstances by chance on a large scale, they can fail to arrive at their overall well-being. Certain intervening factors by chance can impede them from doing so, okay? He's quite well aware of that. So nothing in his account of these matters requires absolute universality. Just as animals make their way towards their overall well-being by instinct, human beings too are ordered towards, we're inclined towards, we have a propensity towards our overall well-being, but we move towards it not by instinct alone, not by impulse alone, not by inclination alone, but by free choice. But by free choice. That's the distinction between human beings and our journey towards our overall well-being and the journey of animals other than human beings or less than human beings. We make our way by free choice. There's another property of our free choice that we can point out regarding this matter, making our way towards our happiness by free choice, and that is that when we do so in our journey towards our overall well-being or our end, as we make our way by free choice, we run into two problems. The first problem is the problem of counterfeit goods, we can call them. The problem of counterfeit goods, okay? What is free choice for Thomas Aquinas? Free choice is regarding these means or ways to the end. These means or ways to the end are the matter for free choice for us. And along the way, we can run into counterfeit goods. There are certain things that look like they will be the essential ingredients of happiness, but they're not really. They seem so, but they're not. So, for example, with a child, eating a massive amount of candy may seem, it really does seem, like it's going to make them happy, like it's an essential ingredient. And so they might choose that as the way to happiness, choose that action of eating just this gigantic bowl of candy or something as if it's going to make them happy. It will seem that way, okay? It's a counterfeit good. Or, I mean, certainly, you know, you've been drawn in or seduced by counterfeit goods at various times in your life. There were certain things you just thought, if I just buy this, if I just have this piece of technology, if I just have this outfit, if I just get to go on this vacation, then that will be so satisfying, so fulfilling, I'll just really, and then you do it, you might even make the effort to undertake this activity, you do it, and then when you reflect upon it afterwards, you realize that was just not really all that satisfying. It just wasn't. I was duped. Okay? Counterfeit goods. That's the first problem we have or need to consider when we think about our free will. We run into counterfeit goods. There's also a second problem that we can point out, and it's the problem of, we could say, self-enslavement. That we start out with a certain kind of ability to choose, but that ability to choose can go one of two directions. It can go in the direction of becoming perfected, it can be developed and matured, or it can go in the direction of being undermined and lost in various degrees. So you may think, for example, of someone who has a drug addiction. When someone chooses heroin for the first time, they set off on a road to increasingly more profound enslavement or compulsion towards the use of heroin. And it starts to seem good to them more and more and more to choose that along the way, to continue to choose heroin, and to such an extent that it can become an overriding good and can cause them that perception, or drag them, we might say, into thinking these other things, like stealing, selling myself into prostitution, or things like that, that would be actually good to do. Why? Because then I can have the money to buy heroin. Okay? And there's a kind of enslavement there where the person has an extreme difficulty in seeing something, seeing getting out of heroin as a good way to proceed, or getting free of the perceptions that stealing or prostituting oneself is a good thing, okay? Because of the grip that heroin has on the person. The person has become, by use of the heroin, someone to whom heroin usage just seems really good, and to whom stealing or prostituting oneself seems good for the sake of heroin. Okay? So there's a problem of self-enslavement. We can become enslaved to various patterns of action along the way. So to sum up, then, our free will seems to be open to development or open to warping in such a way that we can either become more free or we can become more warped. What would be if the heroin addict is an example of someone becoming more enslaved or more warped, so that they find it harder and harder and harder to choose what is truly good? What would be an example of someone whose freedom is developed in a good way someone who becomes increasingly more free, we can consider the example of someone who grows in good eating habits. So if a child starts out early in life thinking, oh yes, eating a bowl of candy would be really, really awesome, let's just do it, and gives himself to that appetite or that impulse, okay, that's gonna set off a certain trajectory of development. But through guidance, through education, through the enunciation of norms and principles that educate the desire to eat, the child can grow gradually into eating the right things at the right time in the right way for the right reasons. And as the child grows in that ability to do so, he or she develops a habit of eating the right things at the right time in the right way for the right reasons. And when that habit is formed, it becomes increasingly easier to do so. And things that are truly good, things that are truly going to lead to overall well-being, actually seem good and are able to be chosen with a kind of peace and ease that we would characterize as freedom. Okay? Whereas the heroin addict, choosing a life without heroin, without theft, without prostitution, what we would say the life that is the overall well-being, that seems bad or seems impossible. That's why we would call that a kind of slavery. Okay? Those are some properties of our free will overall. Let's now get into the essence of it. What is all that whole story I was just telling you, what does that reveal about our nature? What does that reveal about the constitution of human beings or our free agency? I can only give you a kind of overall summary story at this in this context, but I just want to let you know that this could be developed for basically whole courses, okay? We could have whole courses on what I'm about to go through, okay? So let's do it in sort of fast and simple terms. The way that Thomas Aquinas thinks of us is that we have two capacities or two powers in our nature that are distinctive of us as human beings, okay? We have intellect and will. Those are the two powers of the soul that are distinctive or characteristic of human beings as such. He would be opposed, and is opposed, we could say. He would be opposed to any view that thinks of human reason or intellect as differing from the animals just in degree. He thinks there's a difference in kind between human reason and the capacities of the animals, and likewise our will. What is intellect? We could say it's the power to know the truth, the capacity to know truth. But not just any kind of truth, where it's just factual truth of the kind that, say, David Hume would recognize, but precisely to know the truth about the good. One of the things that distinguishes the human intellect from the operations of higher animals is that Aquinas thinks we have a concept of goodness in general. The animals don't have a concept of goodness in general. They're drawn to goods. They have inclinations or instincts towards goods, but goodness is a notion they don't have, okay? Like the universal good, the whole good. They don't have that notion, he thinks. Whereas human beings do have that notion. We have the notion of just goodness. We can say, what do you ultimately want? I want goodness. I want all that is good. It's goodness as such. That's what would make me happy. That's what would fulfill us. That's what would give us this overall well-being, to have goodness just as such, goodness. The animals don't have such a notion. We do. And we could, one definition we could give of wisdom, it's not just Aquinas' definition, it's really found most deeply in Augustine, of wisdom. A definition of wisdom, that wisdom is somehow this ability to understand what's truly good for human beings. Okay? That's what we could say. It's the ability to understand what's really going to lead us to our final end, as distinct from what's going to divert us or take us away or undermine it. Okay? So an understanding of what's going to be truly good for us as human beings. That's the intellect. Now there's also will, which is another power of the soul that we have, distinctive of the animals. And we can understand this as, and here's where I want to be really careful, and I really want you to take note of this. For Aquinas, will is the power to love, the capacity to love. Because we tend to think of will, first off, as a kind of power or executive function. That goes back to that experience of freedom that we have that I was talking about earlier, this ability to opt one for one thing or another, or to execute a plan, to execute a project. That is one of the acts of a free will as such. But that's not will itself for Aquinas. For Aquinas, will is the ability, the power to love. And all human beings have within us, written into our nature, a hunger, we could say a love, for what is good. Now I want to be careful, we have to say it's for what we apprehend as good. Because will is able to love both what is truly good and what merely appears to be good. We can love both. We love those counterfeit goods because they present themselves under aspects that are enticing and capture our will to some extent or in some way. They draw us. They summon us. That new technology exercises an appeal. Okay? That outfit exercises an appeal. That vacation exercises a certain appeal over the will. Okay, by virtue of how it appears at first to our intellect, within our intellect. What's the point of having an intellect and a will? Okay, at least regarding the question of action or freedom. We have an intellect that knows the truth or can know the truth about what is good. We have a will that loves what we apprehend as good. The point is to choose what is truly good, as distinct from what's a counterfeit good or an apparent good. So this is very interesting then. The way that St. Thomas understands a free will is that it's always already, we could say, essentially related to the true good. That's its point. That's its telos. That's its end. The point or the purpose, the goal of a free will is to choose what is truly good. How different that is from the understanding of will that you have from our Planned Parenthood quote, where at the heart of liberty is the right to define, to make. Okay, it's free will viewed under the lens of techne, right? I make of myself whatever I want. To make up your own understanding of the world, of the universe, of life. So it's a making power, it's a manufacturing power almost. Okay? That's where you end, I think, if you think of it as just this raw power to opt for things that are set before us. Okay? For Aquinas, the free will is always already related to what's true good. It's interiorly in reference to the true good or what's going to make us happy. We could give a definition of free will as follows. It's not in Aquinas, but I think it captures a lot of what is in Aquinas. Free will is the ability to choose according to wisdom and love what is truly good. Free will is the ability to choose according to wisdom and love what is truly good. That's what it is. That's what a free will is. What is freedom? Freedom is not just the same as a free will. Freedom is a property of the free will. It's a perfection of a free will. When a person has, by free will, chosen what is truly good, again and again, then the person's freedom grows because the virtues that perfect a free will grow and develop within. And the ability to choose the right things, the right time, the right way, for the right reasons, easily, peacefully, and joyfully, that grows. And that's what freedom is. It's that property of a free will. But likewise, if by our free will we choose counterfeit goods repeatedly or self-enslaving courses of action, then our freedom is diminished, even though the free will remains as a power or a capacity, we should say, of the soul. Okay? The freedom is diminished. It becomes a kind of broken free will. We can grow into that, right? The heroine's free will has fundamentally been warped, become broken in some way. Okay? In order to grow into freedom, what do we need? We don't start out at the beginning of our journey towards the overall well-being. We don't start out with pure freedom. We do start out with a free will, and we have from the beginning certain principles that will lead us into overall well-being, which includes freedom. I don't know if you caught that real quick. I said one of the ways we should think about it is that part of our end, part of our happiness, is freedom. This is one of the ingredients of our end, our happiness. Freedom understood as a perfection of a free will. Okay? A life of slavery is an unhappy life. A free life is a happy life. So when we choose and choose our way towards the overall well-being, we need to be choosing in ways that will promote our development of our own free will in a good way. What are the principles that we need from the beginning of our journey to make our way towards happiness and towards freedom? Aquinas thinks of us as being equipped from the beginning with several important principles, we could say, or constituent factors of our being that set us up to journey towards freedom, journey towards what is true and good by free choice. The first thing we have is something in our intellect that we have up front. He calls synderesis. So the tradition calls synderesis. It comes down to him. It's very closely related to what the previous speaker was talking about. We could say initial conceptions or an initial understanding of what is truly good. We need to have that up front because we don't start out as philosophers. We don't start out as scientists. We don't start out life or our journey towards happiness fully equipped with a complete understanding of what's going to make us happy. What we have is a kind of initial rudimentary understanding of what's going to get us to our end. Or what we could say, an initial rudimentary understanding of what is right and wrong, good and evil. That's called synderesis. It's general. It's vague. It's common to all human beings. And most importantly, it's subject to formation or development or growth. Okay? So, we don't start out with a complete worked out moral code in our mind. We start out with broad, general, vague understandings. St. Thomas thinks that the basic principle everyone has in mind up front from the beginning is do good and avoid evil. Or good is that which is to be done, evil is that which is to be avoided. Okay? That's something we have up front. But obviously, you can see that can be filled in with a lot of detail, okay, about the moral life. And that's what ethics or practical philosophy is meant to do. What ethics, practical philosophy, or instruction in the good life is meant to do is fill out the picture of how we move from where we are into the situation of overall well-being, happiness, how we become free. So for Aquinas then, moral principles, laws, norms, are not simply external impositions or threats. What they are is critical instruction, critical pedagogy that we need in order to develop our understanding of what is truly good, or develop our wisdom so that we can choose from within accordingly what will actually lead us to true happiness, and not down the road of counterfeit goods and self-enslavement. So moral principles, then, far from being an external threat or imposition, are necessary for the development of our free agency. They serve our well-being. They help us. They promote or enhance us as we make our way by choice towards what's truly good. There's another capacity we have in our reason that's very important in Aquinas' story, which is our conscience. Conscience, we could say, is this act of reason, or an ability of reason, to apply what we know by synderesis to concrete actions and circumstances. So, for example, we might know by synderesis, do good and avoid evil. Okay. Some very basic, very elementary moral education or practical philosophy might lead you to an understanding of the norm. It's wrong to kill an innocent person. Okay? So that's a more intermediate kind of moral norm that we now understand. But now you might be faced with a very particular situation in the concrete. You might have a relative, for example, who's in the hospital, who's in the process of dying, is on a ventilator, and the question may come up, should we remove the ventilator? And you have to ask, is that an act of killing an innocent person or not? And reason has to take the general principle, it's wrong to kill an innocent person, and apply it and make a judgment. Is that the norm that applies in these circumstances? And a great deal depends in the particular situation on what exactly is going on. Is the person already in the process of dying? Is there a chance of recovery? Is there not a chance of recovery? Is the person not dying? All those are questions that are morally relevant in the situation. And it belongs to conscience to make a judgment about what to do here and now, given the principles that we're aware of and the understanding that we have. But here's the thing. We all are aware that it's possible at times to know what the right thing to do is and to see what should be done here and now. Our conscience may clearly bid us do this, avoid that in particular, but we still have a difficulty actually executing it. So we need to grow in a particular virtue or disposition called prudence, which is the ability or the disposition to apply, not only to apply what we know, but to actually carry out and execute what we know by virtue of synderesis and conscience in practice, okay, in actual concrete circumstances. And as our prudence develops and grows, so too will our freedom, okay, overall, that ability to live in our overall well-being as, free agents who are virtuous, able to choose what is good easily, peacefully, and joyfully. So prudence is this critical virtue that's sort of at the center of all the whole life of the virtues, because it's a virtue of our practical reasoning governing our actual practices. All of this leads to a certain kind of story that we can tell, and the story goes like this, that as we choose our way from the beginning of our life, according to synderesis, conscience, the stage of moral development in our understanding that we have, the degree of prudence that we have at any one point in time, as we choose our way towards what is good, we are acting towards a certain second nature. We choose our second natures. We don't choose our first nature. We're human beings, constituted by intellect and will, having loves and synderesis, conscience, and the desire to grow in the virtues so that we can become free. All of that we have, that's part of our first nature, okay? But as we choose one way or another, we shape our second nature. By stealing, we become thieves. By lying, we become liars. By, you know, volunteering and giving of time to other people, let's say to serve the poor or something like that, we become generous. We become, increasingly more disposed to give, to love. As we perform acts of kindness in word or deed, we become kind. And we choose our second nature along the way. And our second nature can be one where we are free, having that property of a perfected free will, and in the good, loving what is truly good, living according to what is truly good, or we can have a second nature that is somewhere, we could say, outside of this picture, where we've chosen, over the course of a lifetime, a whole series of counterfeit goods, and we have acquired a second nature that has warped us and undermined us as human beings. Just as a closing illustration of this, I'll leave you with one particular scene from a movie that's pretty classic that kind of illustrates this whole picture. Surely you've seen The Godfather. If you haven't, you should. One of the greatest movies of all time. It's universally agreed, or almost universally agreed. The closing scene at the end of the first Godfather, where you have the Don. Do you remember the scene? He's in the garden with his grandchild. And this is after a lifetime of choosing, freely choosing, to murder, to kill, to steal, to embezzle, to lie, to defraud, to threaten. After a lifetime of doing what mafiosi do, he's sitting in the garden there at the end. And he's kind of talking to himself. And he's looking back over his life. And what does he say to himself? He says, I lived a good life. I did the right thing. I wasn't like all those other people who worked, legit jobs and all that. I lived a good life, okay? It's a powerful, powerful scene because it's a great lesson in what we can become. Here's a guy who seems to see evil as good and see a life that the rest of us, which he has a bad life, as a good life. And it seems good to him. And there's no repentance there. There's no repentance, at least none observable, from the scene of the movie. And then what happens? He has a heart attack and he dies. That's a possibility for a human life on Aquinas' own principles. What happened? You had a human being who had intellect and will and the capacity to choose what seemed good. He had an initial understanding of what was good, and my sense is that it was educated to some extent. He had a conscience. But he continually and repeatedly chose not according to what conscience pronounced, but according to other considerations that came before his mind, based on whatever, passion or other considerations, other sources. And by so doing, he chose, perhaps unwittingly, to become a certain kind of person. And that's what he became. He became the Don, that's possible for a human life. Or we can think of another human being who went another way. You can think of someone like a Mother Teresa, who, same first nature, same principles, intellect, will, understanding, conscience, loves, and she freely chose according to those principles within, Now, of course, we want to say that God's grace is an additional principle that was given to her as well. And she became a very different kind of person, devoting herself to loving, and became, what, filled with generosity, kindness, love, charity. That's a possibility for a human life as well. And both of those possibilities, as it were, are set before our free will. It seems to me like the Don was a slave of the choices he had made, where Mother Teresa was fundamentally and profoundly free. She was free because she repeatedly chose the true good and gave herself to it. So we'll leave it at that, and we'll take questions. Yeah.
Well, thank you. You gave a very clear exposition of this view of human beings being attracted to an abstract general notion of the good, and moral philosophy is the task of filling the details and orienting ourselves to a particular kind of thing.
That's right.
My question concerns moral failings.
Yeah.
Do you think St. Thomas recognizes a failure of the will which is distinct from the failure of the intellect? Or does this view entail a kind of cognitivism insofar as failure of the will ultimately collapses into the failure of the intellect?
He definitely seems to think that you can know the good. No, I don't even say he seems. He believes you can know the good without doing the good. Because something can, you can act on something that's not from the intellect as such. He thinks that passions can influence your perception. And there can also be ignorance. So both ignorance and passion are, we can act on those. They can create appearances within the intellect, but you still might know what's good in habit, right? So you can habitually know that striking someone is just not a good thing to do, right? In ordinary circumstances, striking someone is not a good thing to do, but you're at work one day, your boss just does something that causes you to really start to boil, and passion in that moment can color your judgment so that it seems good, or color your perceptions and your judgment, that it seems good. And at that point, you might know in the back of your mind, or habitually, shouldn't strike people or shouldn't strike this person, but it seems good at the moment, and so you might actually do it. You might actually act on it. So you might know what's good, but not actually do it.
I think about this in, especially in relation to the sort of first principle of practical action involving our interests, namely that what is good is always being pursued and done. So you were distinguishing between a kind of, let's say, a more immediate surface level intellect and a deeper habitual intellect. The surface one always follows the first principle of practical action, but the more habitual intellect has sort of more, perhaps sometimes a more accurate perception of the good, but it's not as immediately into action.
Yeah, okay, so when it comes to understanding principles, just the intellect considered in itself, he thinks there's a range of principles from most general to specific. So we'd say most general to, most specific. Okay, so the intellect can understand these. Everyone, this is like universal and common to all. Everyone's got those synderesis. It's their do good and avoid evil. That's there. Okay? That basically can't be eliminated from the intellect, no matter how corrupt the person. Even the Don at the end of his life still knows that. Okay? The intermediate principles, like, you shouldn't kill an innocent person, that's developed, they're more or less immediate. You should think of this as a range or a spectrum. That's going to be intermediate, but pretty high up. And then there's increasingly more intermediate and more specific ones. Like, here's where you start to deal with, principles about, you don't need to, there's no obligation to pursue useless medical procedures, things like that. Or when a person is in the process of dying, to remove an impediment is not the same as to cause. Now, those are more factual, but you see the point, you get intermediate principles. the more intermediate and more specific you get, the more it belongs to, it's less universal. So not everyone knows these, either in habit or in act, because not everyone has the same degree of moral education or moral formation. And as you get more specific, it gets fewer and fewer people. Also, furthermore, these admit of more and more what we might call exceptions as you go. And that is what calls into play the action of conscience and prudence, is to got to gather or collect the pertinent circumstances and make a judgment in the concrete. At the same time, that's a story about the intellect. There's another dimension of our being, which is our passional life. And passions can either promote or undermine the application of principles in practice, depending on whether those passions have been habituated for the good, as in the case of virtue, or they've been kind of habituated towards evil, in the case of vice or incontinence or something like that. Okay? So that's there's two things going on at the same time. There's one story about intellect properly, just in itself. Then there's another about the whole, we might say, cognitive situation of the free agent. And the whole cognitive situation of the free agent is conditioned partly by passion. Yeah. Yeah.
I have a question about the warping of nature and...
Yeah.
So how much... I agree, kind of feel good, as you mentioned, like, yeah, like a poison, therefore it derives from your character. But is that the only thing? Is the consumption of this good the only thing that warps it? And I'm thinking of two things.
Yeah.
One of them is the... Well, I'm trying to remember the medieval thinker. The one who says it's about choice. So if, imagine that you choose in a matrix style, like these counterfeit goods.
Okay.
You never consume them because they're not real. Is that still warping your nature? But even more extremely, in an Augustinian way, for him, temptation is choosing a lesser good instead of a greater good. So if I'm the type of person that has $1,000 and will always trade them for $10, $10 is not a counterfeit good, it's a real good. But I always trade a greater good for a lesser good. Is that warping my nature, even if there's no counterfeit good involved in the process?
Okay, you got two different big questions.
Yes.
Okay. So let's take the first one first. And I think I'll ask you to repeat the second one because there's a lot built into it, just as a second question. The first one is something like this. If we were in a matrix, like the movie The Matrix, where nothing was as it seemed, I think your question is something like, could we be morally perfected as people in the matrix?
Or morally corrupted.
Or morally corrupted, one way or the other. That's a really good question. I've never thought about that. I think, apart from epistemological considerations, I think Aquinas might say something like that sort of situation is impossible, and we could potentially give arguments against that. That opens up epistemological issues that are really huge. But Aquinas thinks we're always already in contact with reality, like being is first known, okay? If we were in like these fundamental illusions and you weren't choosing the truth according to the truth, right? Choosing what is truly good. Yeah, I don't think you would be perfected.
So Abelard is the one I remember. Abelard is the one who proposes this argument. He doesn't say matrix, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, he misses. So the second one is the Augustinian one. But if we have a... Can you be more corrupted if you always trade in a greater good for a lesser good? I have $1,000 and I will always trade it for 10. Because for Augustine, sin is, like the temptation from the devil is but a trade of a greater good for a lesser good. So if you actually do this in a Thomistic way, because we can recognize certain goods to be goods rather than counterfeits, if you're constantly doing that, is that still a warping, even if you're always choosing real goods?
Another way to answer your question is, is it virtuous? Could one lead a virtuous life?
No, not everything has to be a virtue or a vice, right?
Would it be overall virtuous? Not a particular virtue, but would it conduce towards virtue if you were constantly choosing the lesser good? Is that the question?
No. Will it lead you to vice?
Okay. That's a different question.
Yes.
And I think that we would have to bring in some... I would want to say something like this. In a fallen world, it's it's a very important qualification, where we have the propensities consequent upon the fall, like concupiscence, malice, and ignorance, the wounds of original sin, if we don't actively resist them in some way, yeah, I think that we will, they could seriously undo us, right? So there needs to be active resistance to our propensities that we have, especially towards pleasures, various kinds of pleasures of the flesh. Those need to be positively opposed. So if you continue to choose, as it were, just the lesser of two goods again and again and again, I don't think that that would promote the virtue. And if you weren't actively seeking virtue, you would probably succumb to vice. Probably. Or at least, if not vice, deep incontinence. Not just in sexual matters, but in all kinds of matters. Yeah. We have... You went. So let's get another question. Yeah.
Okay, so... I'm wondering how Aquinas, he reconciles this concept of synderesis with the more anti-innatist aspects of his thought. So synderesis is an inborn but vague notion.
It's inborn, but it's not innate in a Cartesian sense.
I see.
Yeah, so it's inborn in the following sort of sense. Whoever is born into this world experiences the world. Mm. And whoever experiences the world gets the notion of being in their intellect from the experience. Mm. So we can expect all human beings at all times and all places. I mean, as long as you, per se, right? As long as there's no chance impediments, to have a notion of being. And the notion of goodness is coextensive with that. So you're going to be familiar with goodness through your experience up front, right? Mm. Just like in the sense that the initial experience you get from the world is going to get that. So in that sense, it's by nature, in the sense that always or for the most part, human beings have the notion of good. Okay. And if human beings don't have a notion of goodness, we see that as a society as exceptional. And what? There's conditions. That excuses a person, perhaps, or requires a person to be constrained in a certain way.
Okay.
Right? So it's not Cartesian innate ideas, but kind of universally implanted ideas by experience.
I have more of a question, a clarification that I think it's coming out already, the clarification, but I just was wondering if you could help me to understand.
Sure.
It seems in Aquinas' medieval, world, choice was very much less of a harsh, razor-edged thing that modernism seems to present. And if that is true, which I don't know and I'm asking for clarification, is there any way to go back from this, like, knife cut? It's either this or that, and, never the twain shall meet view of the world, to what I'm hearing, which is more of an idea of, like, choices between things that are not so diametrically opposed.
Okay, that question could mean a number of things on St. Thomas's own terms. So he, following Aristotle, has an extensive discussion of what they call the voluntary. So some things we do, they fall under the voluntary. We do them. They don't just happen to us. We do them. Other things aren't voluntary. They just happen to us, right? You're walking outside and it starts hailing. That's involuntary. It just happens to you. But then within that discussion, there's an understanding of what we could call degrees of the voluntary, okay? With the understanding that certain factors can diminish the voluntariety of an action, and that can diminish it to the point of eliminating it, okay? But can also diminish it in a way that doesn't eliminate it, so that you can have actions that have diminished but not completely.
I'm wondering if I'm more talking about the presentation of choices
involuntary
than our choosing choices. In other words, we're hearing in this conversation a lot about choosing the best as opposed to a lesser best.
But, well, that was one
but
question.
But it seems to me as I live in this era
yeah.
in which we have the pleasance to live, everything is like, it's either this or that. You either believe the way we believe or you don't believe. And everything is very diametrically set in antagonism toward each other. Whereas the choice I'm hearing in this discussion of Aquinas is more about things converging to a
mm-hmm.
best option. Now, is that a fair understanding of a difference that has developed since the medieval age to our age?
There's a lot there in what you're saying. I think there's a number of presuppositions underlying it that I think are maybe questionable, to say the least. But let's start out by unpacking it this way. If you look at this as an option, that's not how Aquinas thinks about it. Happiness is not an option that we have before us. It's not an inclination. It's not, we are necessarily inclined towards that, okay? As an end. So that's not just one option that we converge towards or something like that. And choice is specifically regarding the ways to it. And he belongs to a tradition that understands that different particular actions, different particular goods, will seem differently to different people. So to one person, becoming a soldier will seem good. To another person, becoming a soldier will seem bad. To one person, becoming a doctor will seem good. To another, it will seem bad. He has ways for accounting for all that kind of the differences among human beings. Yeah. So in other words, he just expects there to be subjective differences. Okay. Yeah.
I thought that maybe it might be important to confirm that the human being, which perhaps we should have put at the far end of the blackboard, remains at all points very far removed from this end of happiness. And that one of the things that I suppose Aquinas, that prompts Aquinas when speaking of the will as a rational appetite,
yeah.
to place so much emphasis on the relationship, on this sort of contiguity, a kind of narrative contiguity
yeah.
between inclination,
yeah.
habits,
yeah.
and virtues.
Yes.
is to sort of remind us of the fact that this end and the vision of
right.
happiness is something that is incrementally clarified
yeah.
by the intermediate choices of our what we call our second
right.
So that, because otherwise this kind of schema here
yep.
might suggest that someone with 20/20 vision actually has an instantaneous and comprehensive grasp
okay.
of this end.
There's two things to say about that. One is that you're definitely right. This is a very simplified schematic. And when I teach my courses on Aquinas, I elaborate on this over time to realize that each of these means is actually included within a large web of means that constitute a vision or a pre-understanding of the good that we have back here. And yes, it is clarified over time. And there's a narrative unity to the whole thing. And we judge one intermediate end in light of other intermediate ends, and circumstances are a huge part of our deliberations, okay, that are often usually not pre-planned, okay, they just intervene. So yeah, you do have a much more complicated picture in terms of intermediate ends, embedded ends and means, a narrative unity that we're all seeking, and ways in which even life in the modern world has undone that sort of narrative sense of the self by virtue of this understanding of freedom as the ability to opt at a moment for things set before me. And yes, our understanding of the good is clarified as we go. We are creatures in via. At the same time, we do need to watch out for the sense that we only get clear on the moral life or the true good at the end, or like as we get closer. There is a strong sense in which he wants to say, we have a pre-understanding. That's what synderesis and conscience are. We have a pre-understanding, at least vague and familiar, up front, and we are responsible, morally responsible, which means answerable and blameworthy and praiseworthy, for choices that we make towards the end because we have the knowledge already of the ways, at least some of them, like the inner, the higher level intermediate principles.
Which brings me to the second point I wanted to sort of introduce. Let me quote something from a Catholic theologian who says, "I would like, without entering into philosophical disputes, to replace the problematic word synderesis with a much more clearly defined Platonic concept of anamnesis. It is not only linguistically clear and philosophically deep and pure, but anamnesis above all also harmonizes with the key motifs of biblical thought and anthropology derived from it." The theologian is absolutely.
Yeah, sure.
And
thanks.
What interests me is that, to me, that is a persuasive sort of adjustment, because it opens the possibility that at any given moment in our progression, there are, as it were, moments of internal clarification that sort of essentially map onto the Platonic concept of anamnesis, which in a way, therefore, not only show that the particular action in which we are engaged is indeed conducive, or as the case may be, is not conducive to the good, but that in so becoming aware of it, we are also becoming aware of what had in a way given us that initial guidance to begin with. Mm-hmm. So that we are not only clarifying a goal that is yet only partially realized, but we are also becoming cognizant of our own natural disposition to make those judgments.
Okay.
And synderesis as a concept is sort of, I mean, McCabe calls it a little bit of sort of fake Greek, he says. It's not a concept that maps onto any previous sort of philosophical tradition.
Couple things to say, I mean, just in response, like initial thoughts. First of all, Aquinas doesn't think that anyone lives by synderesis alone.
True.
That, I mean, that would be too thin of a moral, of a moral guidance, okay? So it's always a seed that's developed into something more. And the more that that brings it to full, or that is its full flowering or perfection, is prudence. Okay? And prudence, as he understands it, has 10 integral parts. And among the integral parts of prudence is memory. So I think that something like Platonic anamnesis, is something like it or similar to it, is in Aquinas' story. But it's just overlooked if you study just the analytical psychology. If you study the moral philosophy and theology, and you talk about the virtue of prudence, you have memory, and you've got something, I think, akin. And it's an essential part of being prudent. No one can be prudent without a rich memory of the moral life. That would be a principle Thomas could easily affirm. But also, we want to watch out for thinking that you start here outside the circle as an amoral agent, not without any inclination. No, we're always already inclined towards what is truly good and what's going to make us happy. So we don't need to kickstart the moral process that way or ask the question, why be moral? We're always already moral agents. And we do come into, as we come into the good, that means coming into to prudence, because prudence is going to be a part of the good life. You come into prudence, and you will be understanding more and more what it was you were attracted to all along. So I think that you can, between a more Aristotelian way of presenting it and a more Platonic way of presenting it, you can find a lot of overlap and points in common, okay? I'll just leave it at that. This is more looking at it from the external point of view, like here's what a human life, whereas Plato and Augustine are looking at it from the subjective point of view.
James, we have time for one more question.
Okay.
Dominic.
If there's no other question,
I don't see any.
Let me just ask very briefly, I mean, the conference is Christianity and Freedom, and you brought freedom in at various points in important ways.
Yeah.
Can you just sort of underline the final conclusion that this picture tells us about how you become free and to what degree freedom,
that's a great
being
question.
Happy is to be free.
Right, so it seems that to become free and to become happy, you need to cultivate understanding of the truth about the good. That would be one of the principal means. To take this synderesis that we have and to develop those intermediate concepts and, grow in our understanding of the good. And what that understanding will do is educate or form our loves. And as our loves are formed by the true good that we understand more and more, we would grow in our freedom to, or our ability to choose what is truly good. And you grow into freedom principally by understanding the true good. That would be the point of a liberal education, right? They're called the liberal arts because they help you become free. They help you to know the true good. Now, grace is obviously going to be an important part of that story in a fallen world.
If you were to look at this thing, perhaps I think that you would think that I do the loving.
Yeah, that's right.
If you look at yourself within a context of other people, socially,
right,
then I let myself be loved.
Yeah.
Is another kind of active and yet passive,
mm-hmm,
and trusting, whereas you're not rejecting by not letting yourself be loved,
right,
or fearing to be loved, whatever.
Right.
So I think that it's more complete that you're in the context of a family, you're in the context,
yeah,
of other people, and it's not you just loving them,
right,
it's that you are letting yourself be loved by them.
Right.
At all stages of your life.
Yeah.
And as you start being loved much more than loving,
yeah,
you end in old age as letting yourself be loved.
Right, so I think what you're saying might be an important complement to what I just said to Father Dominic. How do you actually grow in freedom? It's not just you start out with all these,
right,
abilities and you just keep doing it. It's, we need to grow in our understanding of the truth, and a huge part of the way that we grow in our understanding of the truth is by actual experience of loving and being loved by people around us. And we start out in that picture. I did say earlier on, this does look, make it look very individualistic, and it's just a limit of the picture. And it's all I had time to,
yeah, because in the providence of God, there is instrumentality.
Right.
And God uses that for everybody.
Right. So this person is actually embedded in a much larger cosmological picture of being, you're given your existence, you're given your capacity to know, you're given your loves, you're loved first, and then from out of that you act. Yeah, we don't have that bigger picture because I couldn't put out that.
I have a question. If somebody says, on the first imagine someone saying, all right, I want to have a better second nature. I want to be a good person and happy and free. Genuine,
sure.
I know the truth. But I can imagine saying to that person, well, the best shot you've got at that, make sure you choose really good parents. We're going to raise you well and,
right,
teach you, give you a good teacher. Make them rich parents, too, to send you to Yale. That is, the factors that are kind of more of my dispositions are largely out of my control. My parents did it too. In the same way, there, most people don't say, when I grow up, I want to be a heroin addict, or,
right,
I want to be a crime boss.
Right.
They find themselves in difficult situations, and they don't know how to make good choices. And how does Aquinas talk about those things that make our dispositions, our personalities, that form our second natures, not because we want them to, but because they are conscious?
Right, he's quite well aware that there are circumstances that have an effect upon us that we don't choose, and we're going to choose according to the dispositions that we have, as things seem to us. But it's not so much that we have to have control over all of the circumstances and things that affect us. The path of virtue and freedom is going to lie in choosing the best. That's going to lie in choosing what's good or what's best, as set before us in the actual circumstances in which we find ourselves. That's what will lead down the path of freedom.